This level of fiscal analysis of the city budget has not happened in at least a decade, if ever. This detailed review is essential for each of us to be successful as we look over, review, and make our budget decisions this fall.
Well, it is budget talk time. It's getting real with Councilmember Dan Strauss there. He is chair of the Seattle City Council's Finance Committee. But why is the council taking this historic step to start budget deliberations about 5 months early? We are tackling that issue, the related concerns over hours getting cut at your local library. We're talking about police recruiting and so much more this week on Seattle News, Views, and Brews, your coffee break political podcast. I'm Brian Callanan. I'm a host on Seattle Channel. The views expressed here are mine. And I'm back with my co-host, David Croman, once again, who is here. He's the City Hall reporter for the Seattle Times. David, I got to say, you broke your streak. You went to a Mariners game and they actually won. How did that happen?
Yeah, I seem to have sort of bad luck, at least in the last few years, that when I go, they tend to not do that well. So, I don't know, I was pleased. I got a good pitching game and just enough offense, and it was fun.
I'll take it. A little something we call the Croman factor. I'm hoping there's more at that this year so that they get some more success. Well, thank you, David, as always, for joining me. Thanks also to our patrons. We got some great patron questions coming in that we're going to answer this week, including one from Blake. Thank you very much, Blake, for supporting the show and also for sending in that question. So we'll talk about that in just a little bit. I also wanted to make sure that I let people know, if you join right now at the low, low cost of $5 per month, you can join our sticker club, folks. This is a great part of being a patron, a nice little side benefit right here. Your very own Seattle News, Views, and Brews decal right here headed your way. If you can join at that level, go to Patreon and check out Seattle News, Views, and Brews. Big thanks also to Converge Media. The video of the podcast is on Converge Wednesday nights at 7. All right, let's get rolling right here, right now. So, David, the City Council has taken an unusual and perhaps historic step this week to start tackling its budget issues here in April rather than the traditional time of September. Councilmember Strauss, the council's budget chair, saying this hasn't been done in a decade, perhaps ever, for the city of Seattle. So they're getting this select budget committee going that's made up of all 9 council members. They are required to be there and make some votes. And I thought this was an important step for a couple reasons, David. One, there's this $240 million budget cap we've been talking about, which is very serious. And two, we just have a lot of new council members who are truly catching up on some major structural budget issues that are going to require a lot of time and study. What do you make of this move by Councilmember Strauss to start these budget talks a little early?
Yeah, I mean, it's not altogether surprising because, I mean, like you said, I mean, this is a city council or a new city council that, you know, on the campaign trail, they use the term audit the budget. You know, they're not literally going to be auditing the budget, but they have signaled their desire to spend a lot of time kind of looking through it. And, you know, so they haven't gone through this before. They're going to require a lot of orientation toward it. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, it's a gap that hasn't been, I mean, I wasn't around after the Great Recession, so I don't know exactly what that gap was, but I think it wasn't even this big. So, you know, it's going to take a lot of time and a lot goes into budget season. You know, it's a fairly quick season because, you know, they take their August recess and then, you know, come back in September and then they've got a basically 2 month sprint to figure it out. But, you know, in this case, maybe 2 months isn't enough. So, not altogether surprising. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, this is going to be kind of their one priority, major priority for this year is figuring this out. So might as well devote some time to it.
Right. And I guess just going down that path a little bit further with you, David, Councilmember Strauss also pointed this out in this week's council briefing. If all 9 council members talk for 10 minutes during the scheduled 120-minute budget meeting, plus there's public comment, it's going to make for some very, very long meetings. Essentially, I think he was urging his fellow council members to refrain from some of the speechifying we've seen over the past couple months and try to make some light of it. But I think there's a serious point to this too, David, which is, as you know, when things get into budget time, and you just mentioned this, the council really gets hunkered down. They don't even have any committee meetings starting up in September. So if anyone was hoping for any new legislation from this council, it basically needs to happen within the next month or so, I think, just to work its way through committees and a full council vote. I guess I wanted to talk about this in terms of expectations for what this council is going to achieve this year, other than budget adjustments, which are plenty important, a big, big issue right now. And I don't want to discount that, but I just wonder what sort of legislation we're actually going to be able to see from this council in 2024.
Yeah, it's a good point. People do forget. I mean, it's really I don't know what the math is on that 9-month timeline, because most real legislation has to be passed by August 1st, essentially, before they go into recess and then start budget discussions. You know, if things are really important, and you know, there have been some fights over this in past councils, if there's some policy thing that someone really wants, they can maybe kind of push it through. But I think in the fall, but I think because there's so much to do around the budget, that is going to be off the table. And so, yeah, I mean, and the only two, I would say kind of the only two real significant pieces of legislation, and even significant is probably an overstatement, that we're seeing are from incumbent council members, so people who have done it before. Councilmember Nelson, I think we'll talk about it, has this piece around post-recruitment and process, and Councilmember Morales has her connecting communities legislation that I think will get a vote today. But the other council members, you know, I mean, they've never written a bill before, so
they don't know.
You know, they're coming into this pretty fresh, and like you said, these budget discussions are going to sneak up on them. So if they won't have some specific piece of legislation they want to pass, got to introduce it like basically now. And you know, I haven't heard that much whiff of any of the six new council members with something kind of in the hopper ready to go. I mean, you know, Councilmember Saka, for example, all of his time is going to be spent around the levy, and so that doesn't leave a lot of time. That doesn't leave a lot of time for new legislation. And you know, there's just kind of a lot of things that they need to react to rather than be proactive this year. And I think that's going to make for a slow legislative year.
Yeah. But again, I guess by the same token, this is what a lot of these council members were elected to do, the basic job of governance. And we'll see how that pans out. So definitely still some questions ahead. But that budget process is off and running this week, folks. So keep an eye out for those different public hearings, because there will be plenty of them throughout the year here to voice your opinions. All right. I did want to talk about some of that legislation that is actually working its way through the city council. So this is Councilmember Morales's Connected Community Development Partnership. David, you just mentioned this and we touched on it a few weeks ago. It's a pilot program meant to encourage development of low to moderate income housing. It's focused on equitable development specifically, and really looking at areas where the city has had a history of racial redlining, trying to push back on displacement. That's the real key here. The pilot runs through the year 2029, or after 35 projects have been applied for, whichever comes first, and these projects would be exempt from design review, could get some added height, no parking minimums, among some other perks there for developers. The next step with this, folks, asking the Department of Construction and Inspections, Planning and Community Development, and the Office of Housing to figure out what are the criteria that will be used to verify who can be part of this pilot program. And David, that was the part that had me asking questions. What is that criteria going to look like? And just getting to the bottom line here, is there going to be enough incentive out there that developers are going to be lining up to do these kind of projects? Because we've seen it over the past year plus here, construction, building permits, that's been relatively stagnant.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, it is sort of caught up in this larger debate around the future of housing development in Seattle, which is ongoing. Mm-hmm. I mean, talked about the budget. See, the comprehensive plan is one of two or three other things that they'll be spending most of their time on. And so, you know, I don't know what the appetite is here from Councilmember Morales' colleagues to do this, especially as sort of separate track from the comprehensive plan, which is sort of how it feels a little bit right now. Yeah, to your main point, I mean, the sort of pilot experiment on some of these kind of policies to encourage development in certain places, it's not a great time to run these experiments because permits are down. As we saw in the revenue forecast, the expectation is development and construction is going to continue to be down. So, you know, I'll be curious to know how you judge this at a time when there are just a lot of other confounding factors.
Right, right. And I should point out, Councilmember Morales does have a lot of support for this legislation. The Housing Development Consortium, Habitat for Humanity, the Urban League, El Centro de la Raza, among others. Councilmember Morales reporting more than 1,000 emails in favor of what she's doing. But it continues to strike me, David, as we work through this type of a plan, the comprehensive plan as well, the city's not allowed to give away its public funds, right? But it's trying just about everything else to try to build low to medium income housing. I guess what impact do you see a program like this having in that larger universe, I guess, of trying to build affordable housing in Seattle? You touched on this a second ago. I just wanted to go down that path further. Where are we heading with this whole idea about affordable housing and how to build it in Seattle?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting because there's, there are a few ways to build affordable housing, and there's kind of new experiments. You know, obviously there's the housing levy to just fund it straight up. There's the mandatory housing affordability, which creates this kind of pot. There's the multifamily tax exemption, which kind of encourages, and now there's the new social housing developer. So this is kind of on that pile of avenues that people are experimenting with to try and encourage affordable housing development. Again, you know, I mean, I think this is sort of an incentive program. I think when you talk to developers, their preference would be to roll back what they see as some of the disincentives to development around permitting and land use restrictions and
design review. Yep.
You know, so design review. I mean, it also the MHA program to an extent, because it does drive up the cost of development. It's a sort of boutique-y kind of pilot program. You know, whether it scales into something that makes a significant difference, again, it's sort of a difficult time to test the hypothesis of the effectiveness of a program like this.
Yeah. It's an interesting one, and I'm looking forward to talking with Councilmember Morales a little bit more about it this week on the Council Edition show on Seattle Channel. So please tune in, folks, and we'll try to learn more about what this program is going to be able to do and the challenges involved with it as well. All right, well, up next, the effort to get more police in Seattle hired more quickly has taken a turn, and how applicants are tested. Well, that process is getting tested itself. Learn more coming up on Now Hear This. Late last week, the Council's Governance, Accountability, and Economic Development Committee got its first look at some legislation that Council President Nelson has sponsored. Council presidents don't often sponsor legislation, so you can tell this is really something that Sarah Nelson cares about. She's talking about improving police recruiting. It's had a rough go over the last couple of years, even with hiring bonuses in place. In 2022, the department lost 159 officers, only hired 58, net loss 101 there. In 2023, 97 officers left, but only 61 were hired, a net loss of 36. Council President Nelson wants to increase the number of applicants the SPD is taking in, and she's talking about using a different test to make that happen. She wants Seattle to use the Public Safety Test, or the PST, which many other agencies use in our region, as a way to make sure the city is catching as many recruits as it can.
Applicants apply to multiple jurisdictions, and so when they take the PST test, once it's on file and they can designate which agencies get that score. And if they have to use another test that nobody else is using, that is, you know, that's a disincentive to include Seattle in their application process.
David, I wanted to talk about this testing issue because, as you pointed out in your writing about this in the Times, there's a little bit of friction on this. Seattle's current test, the National Testing Network exam, is used by several major police agencies like San Francisco and Los Angeles. 68% of applicants pass it. The PST test has a 90% pass rate. It's a tougher test, this National Testing Network exam, and Seattle developed it as the SPD was going into the federal consent decree process, that federal oversight regarding use of force concerns that went into effect in 2012. I wanted to get to that main issue for me, which is, does changing the test have some sort of negative impact on the federal consent decree the SPD is still under? Is that the big driving concern here?
That is the driving. Well, you know, I think the answer is we don't know exactly yet. You know, the head of the Public Safety Civil Service Commission, which is generally in charge of all of this stuff, is kind of conducting what she's called a due diligence on this test, sort of trying to figure out what the implications of it would be. She has sort of asked or you know, has basically said, you know, I need some time to do this and really understand the implications of switching to this test. Council President Nelson has not shown that level of patience, and I think that's kind of where the friction is coming from. President Nelson wants to make the switch soon and now. In fact, this bill that she introduced, she said publicly originally her goal was to mandate the switch, but then, you know, the PSCSC is an independent body, and so there was some question about the legality of her as a council member, whether or not she actually has the authority to override them on this. So the bill was changed to urge the commission to make the switch. But I guess the friction is, you know, because there are the statistics around passage rates, and, you know, obviously folks are super sensitive to not lowering the standards of
they'll move the goalposts.
Seattle Police Department. Yeah, exactly. But you know, there are also some fairly convincing, you know, arguments for switching to this test, as including what Council President Nelson said, which is a lot of specifically Washington departments use it, and that, you know, theoretically could make it easier for applicants to just add Seattle to the box of applications that they're sending in. But again, I think the friction is on who kind of has control over this process. And right now, control is with the Civil Service Commission, and they feel like they need some more time to kind of understand this. This president doesn't have the patience for that right now, clearly, and so is pushing for the switch more quickly.
Got it. And the other piece of the legislation that Councilmember Nelson is talking about deals with moving recruiters out of human resources and into the SPD to help add some accountability, as Council President Nelson was saying here. There's also a plan for a new position on the Public Safety Service Commission to contact people directly who apply within a short amount of time. What are these moves all about, these personnel moves?
The positions in the Human Resources Department are, I mean, those are pretty new positions that were created by, you know, the previous council, and they, you know, specifically for recruitment. But, you know, at the time they were put in the HR department, I think in part because there was still some sensitivity at the time of adding new jobs to the police department. I mean, the council, of course, wasn't full defund the police, but they were getting a lot of pressure to not add to the police. And so I think that's why they ended up in HR. Of course, that has, you know, this new council doesn't care about that and is fine with going to the police department. So, you know, moving these positions into the police department, they feel like basically eliminates a middleman. I haven't heard a lot of protest from either HR or the police department on that. But that, you know, the idea is, you know, I mean, it's such a, we kind of get in the weeds on this stuff, and, you know, Council President Nelson said it's minutia, but important minutia. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is a, police recruitment is a thornier and bigger problem than I would say tests or which tests they're using. It's right. You know, really what they are fighting against is a reputation of Seattle. I mean, a nationwide shortage of police officers. High pay offered by neighboring communities. A lingering sense that Seattle is not a friendly place for police officers to work. And, you know, just legitimate culture questions in the police department. You know, they're still under a consent decree. We've heard some stories about women being unhappy working there.
Sure.
Obviously, there have been some super high-profile cases, like the vice president of the guild laughing about the woman who was hit and killed by a Seattle police officer. So, you know, those are, I think, for my money, the real big issues here.
Right.
But those are hard to control. What is not as hard to control is the process through which applicants move. I'm not discounting that changing that process couldn't make a difference. But when you're talking about wanting to grow a department by several hundred people, four or 500 people, you're going to need to hire at least twice as many as that to make up for attrition. So when you're talking about, you know, basically hiring 1,000 people in some number of time, I don't know that the difference between the national testing network and public safety test, don't know that that's going to be the thing that allows you to hire 1,000 people.
Fair. And I thought it was interesting, too, just talking about how slow the wheels of government grind in a lot of ways, too. Council President Nelson, very anxious to try to get something through here because, as she pointed out, she actually passed some legislation to allow for some hiring bonuses. But as she put it, it really didn't get out to the rest of the world until about a year later. She was frustrated by that. You can tell that this council is eager to make some changes here when it comes to police recruitment. And Council President Nelson is trying to lead the way. So we'll see what happens with this one. But thank you, David, for all that back and forth on the test. That's going to be a very interesting piece of drama to watch out here for. Back to budget issues, if we could. Some challenging news last week. The Seattle Public Library has enacted some rolling closures of its branches based on staffing concerns. David, you wrote about this in the Seattle Times. This is happening because library staff are dealing with a spike in security and behavioral incidents, apparently. So they have to boost staffing at various branches, then close others without a lot of warning in some cases. What's going on here?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you can understand why maybe this would be frustrating to people because we voted on and improved a levy in 2019 to grow staffing, to grow and to increase hours. Of course, the pandemic kind of derailed that for a lot of reasons. The hope by the library system was that they could finally, they did start expanding hours and hiring a lot of people in 2022. And the hope was that they would be delivering on that promise of longer hours by this year, really. But although they have, you know, they, of course, during the pandemic, they lost a lot of staffing. Their total staffing numbers dipped pretty heavily. They've actually basically gotten back to that 2019 level of staffing. But now the goals that they have are loftier, of having these longer hours. And as you mentioned, you know, library workers are reporting more and more behavioral and security incidents that they're needing to respond to. I mean, we know this, that absent sort of more services, libraries or just public spaces in general kind of become de facto, you know, not, if not service providers, you know, responders to an extent.
Yeah.
You know, being a librarian right now means you're dealing with a lot of issues that society has not dealt with very well. And
so, as a result of that, a lot of societal problems for sure. You bet.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you could put bus drivers in that camp, or baristas, you know, anyone who's kind of interacting with the pub every day. And so the library has increased their staffing minimums to make that safe and feel like they can respond to those. But by increasing staffing minimums, then suddenly the staffing isn't enough to keep library branches open. And so that's where we're at. The other angle of this is that there's a hiring freeze put into place by Mayor Bruce Harrell. The library is separate from that. They could have chosen, I suppose, to not follow that hiring freeze, but they are implementing their own hiring freeze for budget concerns. And so they have a lot of vacancies that they're not even advertising for right now. So it's the combination of the increased need and the inability to fill those vacancies right now that means that they're, you know, having to close branches.
Wow. Yeah, it's a frustrating situation. I know it's happening in my neighborhood, close to the Southwest branch. I'm a big fan, and now they're going to be closed on Saturdays. But I think, at least from the library's perspective, it was this idea of we'd rather plan for these closures rather than have sick days and have to necessitate these closures on a more emergency basis. That was kind of the logic behind it, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've heard this from King County Metro and the Washington State Ferries, which is when they have made these announcements of scaling back sailings or schedules. And they're saying, look, we are canceling these, we're making these closures, we're canceling these trips, whatever it might be already, but we're doing so in a way that does not serve the public very well because they don't get any advance notice. So the hope is that by creating a system where these are closed on a predictable schedule, you know, people can adjust their lives and kind of work around that. You know, it actually hasn't worked out that well for the ferries. Their problems continued, but I think it'll be maybe a little easier for the libraries at least. And the hope is that, so you know, there's this hiring freeze, but the chief librarian has instituted a waiver to hire temporary employees. So the hope is that by June they can hire enough temporary employees that will serve at least as a bridge to the fall when the budget discussions happen and they get a better sense of what the kind of long-term situation is for the libraries.
Got it. All right. Well, coming up next, folks, have we got a deal for you. We are answering our patrons' questions. We got a great one coming in from Blake about homelessness. I've talked to the mayor's office about this, Blake. Can't wait to give you an answer here. This is our segment coming up here. You ask, we answer. All right, here we go. Got a great question coming in for Blake. Blake, thank you for supporting the show. Thank you for sending in this question a few weeks ago. Blake says this, been watching the city council meetings on and off since January, and a question came up during public comment in the Housing Human Services Committee back end of March that was similar to something I was wondering. How many of the obstruction sweeps that occurred in 2023 had outreach staff to offer services? How does this compare to prior years? Aside from this question, I'm also curious as to how these sweeps occur logistically. How much heads up is given to a potential set of a sweep? How many people are generally needed to carry out these sweeps? And how is a follow-up handled? Has the new council commented on these existing logistics and if they're looking to make any changes? Well, let me tell you what I heard from the mayor's office on this, Blake, because I thought this was interesting. They gave me a good long answer here. And basically what we're talking about here, at least in the year 2023, last year, the Unified Care Team completed 196 advance notice site resolutions at 154 unique locations, removing 732 total tents. There are some encampment rules there, so offers of shelter are provided. All these advance notice removals that do not fall under the designation of an obstruction or an immediate hazard. As the mayor's office told me, 100% of advance notice resolutions included offers of shelter for those residing on site on the day of posting. Are all those offers turning into people actually going into shelter? We're going to hold on that question for just a second here. But let me go further here. The UCT also addressed 1,945 obstructions or immediate hazards at 382 unique sites, removing 3,316 total tents. Again, city policy is to provide offers of shelter here. When the availability of shelter beds is a factor, the primary challenge to this is the outreach capacity to deploy with field teams to quickly address the obstructions and also look at other hazards that may pose a threat to public safety. In 2023, the UCT says it made 1,872 offers of shelter related to obstruction and hazard removals. And 2023 is the first full year of data for this unified care team. So it's a little bit of an apples and oranges comparing it to the years past. But Blake, I just wanted to make sure I got into a little bit more of this question with you. I'll connect with you offline privately, but I did want to make sure I talked with David about this too. David, when I talk about these this amount of outreach that's going on by the unified care team and the Harrell administration, I think it's safe to say that those numbers are a little bit elevated from what we've seen in years past. Part of that was the pandemic, but it does seem to be a situation where this unified care team is really the mayor's arm to deal with these different encampments, obstructions, or maybe hazardous situations too.
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't know what the hard data on that is, but I think that was when Mayor Harrell took office, some of his first actions were fairly high profile. Reactions to, Woodland Park and 12th and Jackson, in areas where there have been a lot of gatherings of encampments and yes. And so yeah, I mean, I think it's a priority for this administration, but it wouldn't surprise me if you've seen increase in all that.
Yeah, definitely something that they're looking at. And Blake, I definitely thank you for the question. Like I say, let me give you a little bit more of an answer offline here. It's something that we're trying to do for our patrons, really reach out, talk about some of the issues that they're talking about, talk to some elected officials and get some answers about this. So I hope I was able to provide a little bit of context there for you, Blake. I'll make sure to get a hold of you and send you some information so you can follow up more on this topic. Very important one as we talk about homelessness. But it is time to wrap up. David, at the risk of talking about something too hot for the podcast, I saw you post about something rather disgusting in front of your house, some roadkill, and I just had to ask you about it, man. What's going on at the Croman home?
Well, it was a beaver roadkill, and I've never actually seen a living beaver around here or really any signs of beavers, and so that just surprised me. I really like beavers, so I was sad to see him. He unfortunately is still there and smelling.
Oh, no. Okay. Yeah, you don't. You get a shovel. I'm not quite sure what you do on that one. Make a quick phone call, I guess.
Yeah, maybe at this point, I think it's just going to be waiting,
waiting for Mother Nature to take over.
The crows will take care of it.
Yeah. We'll definitely see on that. Well, David, thank you so much for joining me. I hope things get a little cleaned up at outside your home there. And if Mother Nature takes care of it, so be it. Thanks to everybody listening to this episode of Seattle News Views and Brews as well, where you can always find out what's brewing in local politics. Thanks especially to our patrons joining us for the show. Blake, thanks a lot for the question. If you want to be a patron and get your questions answered, find this podcast on Patreon, Seattle News Views and Brews. We'll make sure we reach out to you. You can hear us on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen. And if you do listen, please do consider becoming a patron too. Thanks for watching on Converge Media as well. We'll see you next time.
Seattle News, Views, and Brews is an independent production of Callinan Media Services. Copyright 2024.